Hey, good afternoon and welcome everyone to Family Business Radio. We meet every Thursday right here on Business Radio X at 1 o'clock, and I am one of your co-hosts, Pat Romboletti with Sage Executive Search, and I want to welcome my co-host, Meredith.
Hi, I'm Meredith Moore with Moore & Associates Wealth Management, and I'm very excited about our show today.
You're always excited about a show because we always have exciting topics.
So I know, but we have a fellow Atlanta Business Chronicle 40 Under 40 and a fellow North Fulton professional, so I'm very attuned to these two guys.
Perfect. Well, let me remind our listeners that through Family Business Radio, we are really showcasing family businesses and building a community designed to educate, inform, and support family-owned businesses. Each week, our guests include family business owners, key executive non-family members who are helping to drive those businesses, and the trusted professional advisors that assist them, which is part of our guest today.
You know, it's occurred to me that we really need to kind of restate some of the statistics that you first gave out in the show, on our very first show. And I think a lot of people don't really understand the significance that family business plays in our world today. So let me go ahead and hit on some of those topics. First, 80% of the world's businesses are family-owned, 80%. A third of all the companies on the S&P 500 are family-owned. And family-owned businesses account for more than half of the nation's gross domestic product, and they account for 60% of all the total U.S. unemployment, or excuse me, rather employment. That's probably a little bad on my part given these times. So 60% of the total employment, 78% of new jobs, and 65% of the wages. That's pretty significant.
Exactly, and I think everyone out there in our audience will attest to the fact that with the recent recession, many people are launching businesses and going to smaller companies where they feel they don't have the stability in corporate America anymore. So I think that will be an ongoing trend and something powerful for family businesses. You know, family businesses face unique issues. There's succession planning, marriages, divorces, complicated relationships, as well as routine issues that emerge around turf battles and shareholder control, compensation structures, and processes for strategic decision making. Our topic today, which is risk management and real estate, comes into play around almost all of those issues in one way or another. So while every business owner needs to understand risk management and real estate issues, there are some aspects of these issues that are unique to family-owned businesses. So today we'll cover the topic in general and the aspects that are unique for our for family businesses. And to help us cover those topics are a couple of experts. First, Josh Hirsch, who's managing director with Studley. Josh, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit about Studley, what they do, and then your particular role there?
Sure. So Studley is the largest commercial real estate firm in the country that specializes in just representing tenants. We are based in New York. We've got about 450 brokers across the country. We're in most major markets. And my role there is primarily helping office tenants, some industrial manufacturing tenants, with a variety of lease issues. So lease negotiation, finding space, structuring leases, understanding the financing behind each transaction to make sure that it works for the tenant. And we, like I said, work on a national basis, and I'm based here in Atlanta. I've been with the company for 10 years, a little stint in Atlanta, a couple years in San Francisco, and then back here since 2003.
Well, we're glad to have you back. And I noticed that when you're here, you're pretty involved in the community. So there's Chamber of Commerce. Tell us a little bit about that. And I see that you're very active in baseball, and it is opening weekend. The season's opening. So pretty excited about that, I'm assuming.
I am. I'm a big baseball fan. I'll be going to the game Monday downtown for the Braves. But in the community, I do work with the American Israel Chamber of Commerce, which is an organization that helps emerging Israeli companies who are trying to do business with Southeastern companies. So we help them partner up either on the drug development side if they're a biotech firm, or on the internet banking side if they're on the credit processing world, and you know, all sorts of emerging Israeli technologies are looking for ways to partner with large companies in Atlanta, Home Depot, Coke, Delta, so on and so forth. So we help with that. I'm on the board of a local charity called Kate's Club, which raises money and is a platform for children who have lost a parent or a sibling. So we help them gain access to certain types of therapy and to certain types of activities And then, like you said, I coach baseball over at Chastain Park, which is a local organization here, and we've been doing that for about 6 years, a friend of mine.
Well, I suspect that's probably why you joined Meredith on the Club of the 40 Under 40. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Meredith hasn't had to brag on that. We've just talked about her being on there, but I'm looking for the six, you know, sexy over 60. But tell us about the 40 Under 40.
It's a very nice, humbling honor. The Atlanta Business Chronicle puts it out every year. There's 40 people. It's a very diverse crowd, some nonprofit, some wealth management, real estate, civic. They do a nice job getting the cross-section together. I was surprised by the award. It was a very nice honor, and you know, I think it's just sort of a testament to working hard and doing a good job for your clients.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And Dan, I know you are with Southern States Insurance. Can you tell us a little bit about what that firm offers and then a little bit about your role there?
Absolutely. Southern States Insurance has been around for 15-some years. I recently joined it 2 years ago. After selling my ownership in another agency in Atlanta, and as Meredith mentioned earlier, getting back into North Fulton County to be more of the dad at home a little bit, mm-hmm. spend some more quality time, be involved in the various organizations I'm involved with. Pat, we've got 8 offices. We've got 7 in Georgia, 1 in North Florida. We specialize in just about every aspect of the insurance business. The area that my expertise is in is commercial insurance, which is business insurance, typically anything from the mom and pop, you know, small store startup types on up to corporations. I've worked on accounts that pay as much as $1 million a year in premium for all their lines of coverage. So I kind of experienced the gamut, if you will, on the insurance side.
Well, I noticed that you have an advanced degree from the Society of Certified Insurance Counselors. What's entailed in achieving that?
Yeah, the CIC designation, as it's often mentioned in our industry, is a 5-year program. You could do it in less, but it's pretty demanding from that standpoint. And it's just more of an in-depth, not quite to the level of a graduate degree, but certainly much more involved than just your standard insurance license. It gets you a broader view and a different perspective, actually, on how the insurance industry works.
Excellent. You know, I don't want to tip our topic hand too much, but when we were chatting before the show here in the studio, you mentioned that this issue of family-owned businesses is kind of up close and personal. Can you tell me a little bit more and tell our audience a little bit more about that?
Sure. My grandfather, many, many years ago in the farming business and raising cattle in Iowa, put together one farm and then a second and then a third and built it up to multiple farms, which currently are all being used to grow corn and soybean. The family business had some issues early on as to who was going to be in charge and who was going to have a say, and he put a stop to that immediately. He took the majority of the farms, put them in a trust, did it in a generation-skipping way so that they're in the names of myself and my cousins and my sisters, yet we have no voting rights. We have personally no income from them. All of that is generated back to my parents, my aunts and uncles, as their inheritance of income. So it's an asset that generates revenue that we have ownership in, but we have no say or management, if you will. Which actually is pretty good because I don't know too much about growing corn and soybean, to tell you the truth.
Well, you know a lot about insurance, and that's what we're here to talk about. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to start by really trying to address the overall economic realities of the commercial real estate world. Josh, and I thought it'd be good to kind of start with you, and if you can kind of give us an overview of not just the state of commercial real estate, but specifically as it pertains to the Atlanta area.
Well, it's a broad question. There's a lot going on right now, but for the purpose of this show in particular, where we're talking about either tenants or users of space, this is a very good time to be a tenant. There is a tremendous amount of concern in the landlord community. Vacancy rates are very high. They're unhealthy. Most healthy vacancy rates are usually in the 8-12% range. And depending on which market we're talking about, Buckhead, for the people listening in Atlanta, Buckhead is the most high profile sort of sexy market, if you will. They've had this unhealthy exuberance of development, And it's really created vacancy rates in the high 20, almost 30% range.
Wow.
So when you're a landlord and you're trying to cope with that, you're having to get incredibly aggressive in terms of offering concessions to tenants. And we'll talk a little bit about lease term and where that comes into play. But not just Buckhead. Buckhead is indicative of a lot of Atlanta and for the most part, a lot of markets in the country. So as we've seen the recession take over, and I know it's scaled back a little bit recently, but without job growth, it's going to translate into less demand for office space. The vacancy rates have been very high. It's very unhealthy for landlords, and it creates a very good market for tenants. It doesn't create a free market for tenants, but it does create an environment where if a lease is structured properly, a tenant can lock into certain lease rights and certain opportunities for flexibility to grow the business over the coming years, and do so at a low enough rent constant that it's attractive to be in the market, or if you weren't even planning to be in the market, it's attractive to look at opportunities that you weren't aware that previously may not have been aware to you.
Now, how does that pertain to family business? I mean, what does that bottom line, that summary, how does that affect the family business owner?
Well, I think it's a good time for family businesses to take a look at how much they're currently paying for real estate. You know, whether it's a small management office, whether they're doing, you know, wealth management or medicine or whatever it is, so they only have a couple thousand square feet, it's still a big expense. Usually for a service-based businesses, the occupancy cost is generally the second highest expense on a P&L. The highest is usually your payroll. So this can be a very big cost. I think it's a good time for people to take a step back and look at how much they're spending and if there are opportunities to renegotiate those costs. And if you are a young family business and looking at ways to lock in a long-term, low-cost lease with flexibility and different types of rights to protect you in case of changes in control, and we can talk about, you know, the benefits of termination and contraction rights. Tenants have so much leverage now that they're able to go in and negotiate those types of rights. So it's not just for the benefit of large corporations. I think that all tenants right now, all users of space, can go ahead and sort of recast or restructure the lease that they're in and try to find ways to make the lease benefit their business.
Now, are you seeing tenants that you kind of alluded to this, or are people, is all of the tenants, are they wanting something for nothing? I mean, you said it's not a free-for-all market, but what are some trends that you're seeing on the tenant side?
So at the end of the day, real estate leases are essentially just rolling upfront concessions over a long period of time. So my advice right now is to go ahead and get as much as you can because the leases are so cheap and roll them into a long-term lease. And I think that's the trend that we're seeing, is that if you really want to take advantage of the landlords who are desperate, the banks who realize that they have to get some income, whether or not it takes them 3 or 4 years to recoup it is one thing, but at some point they're going to get income after the concessions burn off, you're going to have to give a long-term lease. So I think that is a smart strategy. I think it's the right strategy, but I don't think it's the only strategy, and I think it needs to be piggybacked with flexibility later on in the lease, so that if the market comes back strong, that's probably one thing to say. If the market stays weak and there's opportunities to renegotiate again later, you want to have flexibility for that. And if there are changes with the family business, if there's generational issues, there are ways to get out of it. But I do think that we haven't seen rates this low in a long time. We haven't seen concessions this high. We haven't seen periods of free rent. I mean, for a tenant that leases a full floor on a 10-year lease, you're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 years of free rent. That's a long period of time. Mm. And you're looking at landlords being able to fund not only the entire cost of construction, but if the lease is well negotiated and the underwriting allows for a certain amount of construction dollars that you don't use, you want to be able to have discretion over how they're used and potentially reduce your cost even further. So there's so many opportunities now to take advantage of the underwriting that's out there and either pocket money that's not being used for the space or directly impact the cost of the lease that I think to answer your question, the trend that we're seeing is locking in for a long term so long as you're protected at some point during the lease.
So what I'm hearing is that we know that family-owned businesses are going to need as much flexibility as possible because what their decisions are impacting multiple generations. And this is a time, I kept hearing you say the word concession. So this is a time where concessions are most favorable for the lease, the person leasing, and therefore most favorable for family businesses because they need that so much.
Right. So a couple of years ago when the market was stronger for landlords, it was very difficult for tenants to get rights to get out of a lease. So they signed a 10-year lease because everybody was doing well. It was 2007, and sales were up and job growth was up and everybody was very happy about the way the business were being run. But if the sticking point in a negotiation was getting flexibility or a termination right halfway through a 10-year lease, a landlord very well would have said, you know what, we want your business, but that's, you know, there's no reason for us to do that because if you turn around, someone's going to come in behind you and lease the space. So it's not that big of a deal to us. But nowadays, you know, space can sit for, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Mm. And this is specific to Atlanta, but I know that there are other markets in the country, Dallas being one of them, Chicago being one of them, where the vacancy rates are comparable. So as a tenant now, there's a window to go in and really press for those concessions. Because if you don't do it now and your lease is up in 3 years and you think it's too early, the market might get away from you.
Exactly. You know, many of our family business owners are really one of the big niches in family businesses, distributor. Mm-hmm. So they are wholesale distributor, which means they have warehouse. They may have office space that is their business office, but warehouse is that huge number that you quoted in Buckhead, which I know affects everybody else because they have to remain competitive in the perimeter and elsewhere. Is that equal in the warehousing space, or is that not quite as?
It's not quite as dramatic. Industrial real estate, for the most part, it's certainly not recession proof. I mean, manufacturing sectors get hurt like everybody else, but the developers and the industrial side didn't seem to be as, I guess, arrogant is the right word, mm-hmm. to the extent of, you know, building so much speculative real estate that it hurt the market. I think for the most part, they have the real estate in check. It's certainly a tenant's market. But on the office side, when I tell someone with 3 to 5 years left in the lease, let's take a shot at it, either renegotiating the entire lease or just renegotiating certain lease terms. Because of where the market is, I don't think you have that kind of leverage on the industrial side, but you do have leverage. I wouldn't tell people not to see what can be done, but I don't think that if you have 3 or 5 years left, you're going to get the same response as you would on the office side.
Let me address the industrial aspect. Now, let's just pretend I know nothing, which I kind of don't, about commercial real estate. What if the family-owned business, when it comes to these bigger manufacturing plants, are there lease to buy programs where typically we see trends in family business where their biggest assets is the stock within the family business as well as real estate? So eventually, if they're wanting to acquire that property, are there common leases where there's options to do that?
Let me sort of answer that question by giving some context as to where we are in the financing cycle. So very similar to the residential market in 2007, a lot of interest-only loans were put into the market, and they were put in the market on the commercial side. So we're seeing from 2006 to 2007 and somewhat in 2008, a number of 5 and 7 year interest-only loans that have balloon payments that are up in 11, 12, and 13. And that's really causing a lot of the opportunity for tenants now, is that there's a huge amount of refinance risk in the market. So if you own a building and you have a big tenant in there and the tenant's lease is up in the next couple of years and the loan is up in the next couple of years, then the tenant can go and say, look, without me here, there's no chance a bank is going to refinance this. And with me here, you're going to have a hard time because banks aren't really doing any sort of lending on commercial real estate, but you need me in place. I think to answer your question, there's an opportunity now to go to look up the information, and it's available if you know where to look, and you know, we have a research department that does it, but it's public record when these leases are filed. I mean, when the loans are put in place, to find out what the loan situation is on your building if you're a tenant, and say, not only do I want to renegotiate, but I may want to look at doing a lease purchase, or I may want to just buy the building outright from you. And I think because of the refinance risk over the next 2 or 3 years, this is a good time to explore what kind of financing options are available, and like you said, explore sort of different occupancy costs, whether it's a mortgage or whether it's a lease. And there's been a lot of discussion in the Wall Street Journal and a lot of more real estate specific trends where this big commercial real estate bubble is going to come due in 2011. And a lot of banks are kicking that issue down the road 2 or 3 years. They're extending them by a little bit because, frankly, they don't want to deal with it right now. But at some point, they're going to have to deal with it. And the tenants or the users will be the ones who benefit from it, whether it's repricing a lease or whether it's taking advantage of an opportunity to own.
Mm. You know, Dan, when we spoke earlier, you talked about the impact of this economy. And it has some impact on risk management perspective in terms of what the basis of the premiums are and what things have to be, what people have to be on the lookout for. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, that this economy is impacting even that?
Yeah. Insurance, from a liability standpoint, this is what we're talking about to mm-hmm. kind of clarify.
Right.
Liability, workers' comp. We have buildings, we have equipment, vehicles, trucks, things of those nature that you typically see in the business environment. These companies are still in business, but they're not the same footprint that they were in 2004, 2005. You could still be a home builder and still building houses, but you're building 10 a year now versus 300 a year back in 2004. With that, your insurance cost is a portion. Your insurance cost for liability is based on one of three things in business: square footage if you're in a retail situation, sales if you're in or sales or payroll depending on whether you're providing a good or a service. So all of those are notched down, and it has affected the insurance industry as a whole that typically was accustomed to having obviously larger premiums come in. So we've shifted, we've changed with the times as everybody else has. So your insurance cost. A quick story, the first couple of years in business, I had a client that had an audit. The audit checks what their sales were for the year and what their payroll. And when I explained to him how it worked and the fact that he owed the insurance company another couple thousand dollars, he looked at me and said, "I didn't know we were partners." So that was an eye-opener from the beginning. It is. It's a direct correlation to the amount of business you do.
So if I am a business owner and my premium comes due every December and I notice March my business has shrunk, do I have then the option of picking up the phone and calling my, if my agent hasn't called me, which I'm assuming a proactive agent would have, am I calling them and am I able to do something in between the terms of that policy?
Absolutely. One of the biggest examples we saw of that, they didn't used to like to do that, mm-hmm. if used to like is a good term. When the Olympics came to town, was a good example. I had clients that did a lot of business in the 2 years leading up to the 96 Olympics, disproportionate to their actual business model. And in 1997, the insurance companies came back and said, "Okay, we want to collect premium X based on your history." For the next year, we had to go in and say, no, look, they did construction at the airport. That's over. It's done. He's gone from his height. He's going back to where he should be. So that kind of set the trend a little bit, at least in my relationships with these insurance companies. And your agent should be talking to you typically 60 to 90 days before your policy renews. Mm-hmm. And as I conduct these renewal interviews, if you will, we talk about that. What were your sales last year? What was your payroll? What do you anticipate it being going forward? And if we anticipate it being down, I will go back to the insurance company and have them adjust it at that time. And then to answer your question directly, Pat, yeah, if your insurance renews in December and you had visions of doing a certain amount of business and in March, April, May, you come to me and say, "We're not going to get close," your agent should be able to go back on your behalf and negotiate that down for the remainder of the policy period.
What would you say on the commercial property and casualty side? What are some things that some claims or some issues that might specifically affect family business?
Well, as boring as insurance can be, I try not to bring it up at cocktail parties because I wind up standing by myself. But you really, as a business owner, need to take at least once a year a really good look and spend the time to understand what it is you have. I met with a guy last week in the furniture business, and he said, look, I'm not an insurance guy. And I said, well, I can appreciate that. It can be complicated. I am, and that's why I'm here to discuss this. He said, no, you don't understand. I can't stand insurance. I don't want. If this is going to be an hour meeting, I'm canceling it right now. So
fun.
Yeah, you know, sometimes. But I caution people to take on taking that approach. As painful as it is doing your taxes at least once a year, as with insurance, you have to take the time, suck it up, if you will, and get involved and understand it. So, Meredith, the point I'm making there is you need to make sure that your insurance is at an adequate level to protect the assets of the family business, or that family business may not exist for the next generation as you intended. We tend to see people a little bit in the older generations, or old school, if you will, that will sit there and tell you, I can't stand insurance. It's a waste of money. It's a ripoff. And unfortunately, those people tend to be underinsured. And in the event that they have a big loss, and I typically look at the two in Atlanta that come into play, would be a large fire or a tornado. The most common, devastating, and more frequent occurrences. If a business is underinsured and that business is temporarily wiped out by one of those scenarios, the money's not there to rebuild it. And without getting too much into insurance 606 down the list, is there's something called coinsurance, which is an additional penalty that a business owner can face for not having adequate insurance.
How is that monitored or regulated?
Unfortunately, typically at the time of the loss. Mm-hmm. So on the front end, the insurance company says, look, business owner and insurance agent, if you say the building's worth $500,000, we're going to take your word for it. Now, they will double check when they look at square footage in the construction, and they'll know if it looks like it's way out of whack. But, yeah, if it's off at the time of the loss. So that's the responsibility of the agent to discuss and lay out with the business owner.
So would they get then the limits of liability? They would get their settlement, but they would have to pay a penalty. So whatever minimal coverage they would have minus the penalties would be the settlement on the issue, on the fire, if you will?
Correct. It's
wow.
Simple equation, did over should times the loss minus the deductible.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Y'all got that?
Got it.
Absolutely.
I already did the math.
That's why you're here.
So, you know, what I hear, Dan, is that the younger generation, the next generation coming along in the family who may feel like, you know, the insurance is mom and dad's problem, they've always handled that, or maybe the finance guy, that if they really want to take an active role in the business, and one of our guests a couple shows ago emphasized that the younger generation should be taking an active role, they need to really be speaking up and looking at this, because they're going to bear the brunt of the underinsurance.
Especially with the cultural aspects of what I think Dan is speaking about, mm-hmm. with the boomers and the World War II generation really discounting the role of proper insurance coverage. Is that kind of where you're going with that?
Absolutely. And again, like I said, it's akin to doing your taxes. You don't want to face it. You don't want to deal with it. But at least once a year, take the time with an open mind and understand it.
What about, let me give you another claim scenario. What happens if you, let's say you have a family business, 20 employees, and one of the minority shareholders is little Johnny, who's, you know, 22, and he's in a company car and goes out and gets into a bad wreck or does something he's not supposed to be, and there's a claim. Now, you're dealing with a family business. Typically, do the owners, or they're going to have the coverages, say, on the cars or on the assets, but how does that affect family dynamic? How does that affect coverage payouts, things like that?
Well, as far as the family dynamics go, that's probably going to be discussed over the kitchen table at home. From an insurance standpoint, as I tell clients on a regular basis, the insurance companies that I represent, I'm an independent broker, so I represent a lot. I'm not going to put you with anybody that's going to leave you hanging from that standpoint. They're going to back up, and they're going to cover that claim for little Johnny, 22 years old, coming out of Buckhead that wrecks the car.
Even though he's the owner, he's an owner as opposed to – he's an owner employee as opposed to just an employee.
Correct, but under the definition on all insurance policies that we deal with, the definition of who's an insured – treats them equally, owners, officers, spouses in their relation to business, as well as employees, all carry the same level of protection as far as the definition of who's covered.
So spouses of owners, even though they have no ownership?
correct as it relates to business, because often spouses are attending functions on behalf of the business with their other spouse. My wife's been to a few too many insurance functions, and she will tell you there's a good chance a claim could have happened at a few of those.
Okay, no, that's good to know. That's very interesting. One other thing, too. Could you talk a little bit? I think this is important for the audience to hear, because I know I get questions in my practice about your world and property and casualty. Can you really differentiate the model of the independent property and casualty broker versus the captive model and the pros and cons, especially as you get to a more established business?
Sure. The best way to define, and although it is evolving, the traditional captive agent, meaning they represent one company or two companies, whatever that number is. We tend to think of State Farm, used to be Allstate, Nationwide, although they've got some latitude with what they can do. But for the most part, yeah, you're representing one company. The pros there are is they tend to do one or two things. Well, they tend to do a handful of things very well. And if it fits inside their box, they're just dynamite. They do a great job. But anything that the least bit hangs out of that box, their hands are tied. They can't do anything. As an independent agent, which is what I am, we have the ability to take your scenario and put it together in a format that we can present to multiple insurance companies and say, hey, we think this would be a great fit. What is your response? And their response would be, yeah, not only is it a good fit, here's the price we're willing to offer. We also have an opportunity or a responsibility to know these insurance companies' strengths and weaknesses. So if you're a manufacturing company, Company A might say, hey, we love manufacturing, and we turn around and say, we know you do, but your pricing on your auto is outrageous, so you're not a viable candidate for my client. I'm going to have to take him down the street.
More options. You know, Josh, on our show, we have emphasized week after week after week the role that a trusted advisor can play. It's a third party outside that can bring expertise and bring you an insight that you just can't, especially as a family business owner just running so many. So if someone's seeking to lease space for their business, how can they fully leverage someone like yourself?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I think real estate brokers are usually associated with finding space,
right?
Which is sort of 101 for what we do, and it's not why I would advise hiring a broker. If you're just going to hire a broker to find space, then with all the publications out there, you probably don't need one. Mm-hmm. But where a good real estate broker, and especially a tenant representative, can come into play is by doing a couple things. First is creating a competitive environment. So there's, like we said, a 20% vacant market out there. You want to make sure that all of the landlords are competing for your business and that you're positioned properly. So you want a tenant broker that understands your financials, the way the family business is set up, so that if there's going to be an event in the next couple of years that comes into play within the way that the lease is structured. You need someone who understands the different landlords in the market. So some landlords are set up as REITs, some landlords are set up as pension funds, some are individual owners. You want to make sure that the negotiations with each of those types of landlords is handled in a certain way. So, for example, a private landlord, someone who just owns a couple of buildings in town, may be more concerned with cash flow up front. They can't sustain giving free rent for 2 or 3 years. But a pension fund might be able to because of the way that they book the lease once it's signed. So that there are some differentiating factors there. You want a tenant broker who understands the nuances of each aspect of the lease, not just what the rent is. So a couple of notes that I wrote down, you know, the difference between a right of first refusal, for example, and a fixed expansion right. So a right of first refusal says that when you lease space, whether it's a warehouse or an office, if the landlord gets an offer to lease the space out that's adjacent to yours, for example, then you have the right to lease that space first. Well, it sounds like a good right. And a lot of people ask for it in the lease, but in reality, they could get that offer a week after you move in. Mm-hmm. So you've gone through this entire exercise, identify how much space that you need, and then a couple days later they say, well, do you want more? And if you don't, you're going to lose that space. So one thing that we try to do, for example, is to have fixed rights, which is to say at year 3 or at year 5 in the lease, no matter what's happening in the space next door, they have to offer it to you at a certain price, And if there's a tenant in there, then they have to move that tenant. It creates a much stronger environment for your lease because you really control the way that the building works to support you. So those are two things, for example, that we do. I mean, there's tons of others. I would make sure that the lease audit right section, for example, is negotiated properly. So, you know, sort of like Dan was saying, with auditing insurance, you should be auditing your lease, and you should be making sure that you're not overcharged for certain expenses. And in this environment, I'm sure you can imagine that landlords are trying to squeeze pennies wherever they can, and they're trying to, you know, say, hey, they'll never notice this. We increased our management fee from 3% to 4%, and the lease said we couldn't, but, you know, it looks like an annual escalation, and we're going to pass that through. So, you know, to answer your question, I think it's not just what is the rent and where is the building, but it's who is the landlord, how is the financing set up, what sort of generational issues are coming up so the lease can be flexible for those. You know, what sort of rights do I have beyond the basic ones? And you know, I think a good tenant broker would really understand all of those aspects.
You know, you just brought something up that I think people maybe don't think about, and that is, so they're looking at the cost per square foot. Maybe they're looking at the build out, mm-hmm. and that's where they're thinking. But what else is tacked on? You talked about that auditing. So I walk in. What do I need to be aware of that I might get a bill for? Monthly, quarterly, annually, that is a shock to some people?
Well, there are two types of leases. So there's a gross lease, which is a rental rate that incorporates your operating expenses, and it increases every year based on how those operating expenses increase, in addition to the rent increasing. So let's say that it's $20 a square foot. The lease will say that goes up by 3% a year, but also whatever component of that $20 is operating expenses, let's say it's 10, if that goes to 10.50, then there's an additional 50 cent increase. So you want to understand what's within those operating expenses. A lot of times landlords will try to include capital in there where they should have reserves to fix the roof, but they want to pass those through to the tenant. And if you audit it properly, then, for example, those shouldn't be passed to the tenant because that's not part of the everyday operation of the building. That's more of an owner's obligation to keep the building, you know, in a certain condition and repair. So that's one thing. But on a net lease, which is the other kind of lease, the tenant is responsible for all of the expenses. So for the gas and electric and for the maintenance and just the common area upkeep, so to speak. And those two types of leases are different. I prefer gross leases because they put more of the burden on the landlord. So if you're a small family business leasing space somewhere, I would rather see someone in a gross lease where they can point to certain audit rights, they can point to certain language that was negotiated, that if there's a discrepancy, we can say, hey, look, this was not our fault, and you have an obligation to fix this.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
How often should they be doing the audits?
Audits are usually done in the spring, so the reconciliation statement will come out sometime in the March or April timeframe. And we would suggest there are several firms around the country that we like, and you know, I can give you those names off the air, or we can figure them out later on, but who just specialize in office and warehouse lease audits. A lot of times leases will say that you have to use a Big Four CPA firm, which we've been successful getting those eliminated from leases, because as long as someone is working in a capacity where they're an expert in doing these types of audits, I think you can make an argument for that.
Yeah, you know, we always have a follow-up on our website, so for those listeners, we'll be sure to have that information up
sure.
there, and they can refer to that. As I listen to you, you know, as we sit here in the shadows of UPS and Coca-Cola, they mm-hmm. all have a huge real estate department, and there's somebody in there looking after them and negotiating all of this. And what I think I just heard is that, you know, for a family-owned business, they're not going to have a real estate department for the most part, you know, the average size that we all know of. So it sounds like your service kind of plays the role of an outsourced real estate expert.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, even on the bigger scale, companies turn to us because we do this every day, and our competition does this every day on the tenant side, but especially with a smaller business. So this is an interesting statistic. 67% of the tenants who lease office space in Atlanta, and I think it's very linear across the country, lease less than 5,000 square feet. And of those, 50% lease less than 2,500 square feet. So the market, you know, assuming the market is 67%, is leasing a small portion of a floor.
Right.
They're not the Cokes and the Home Depots of the world.
Right.
And a lot of those are family-owned businesses. So when you're comparing yourself against the majority of leases in the market, if you're a big tenant, you don't want to compare yourself to the market because you've got more leverage by using your balance sheet and other tools to get a stronger lease. But if you are a family-owned business and you're a 5,000 square foot tenant, then it's important to know where the market is, and it's important to have those resources, and it's important to have an advisor who's got access to that information.
And what do I pay as a lease, somebody trying to have you of service to me? What is my cost? Because if I had an internal real estate person, I know what that would cost me.
Well, it's very similar to the residential business where the seller pays the commission. So the landlords pay us even though we are representing the tenants. Some people ask us, how do you know we're getting the best deal? Because if you're getting paid a percentage of the lease and then you don't push hard enough, then all of a sudden we're paying a higher lease because you wanted to get a higher commission. And the way to answer that is that, we have a reputation and we want to do the best job for our clients. And, at the end of the day, our business is representing tenants and they can be assured that we're going to do the best job for them.
That's good. Yeah, I guess that answers
the question.
Yeah,
that's great. So I get all of that, and somebody else pays for it.
That's right. I mean,
I like that.
Yeah,
I'm liking that.
Essentially, it's like a residential purchase where the commission is wrapped into the cost of the transaction. So the tenant really does pay it over time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think any real estate broker who's representing tenants is going to create more value, not just financially by lowering the cost of the transaction lower than the commission, but by building in certain rights into the lease that if a tenant ever needs to use them, they're invaluable, and they can be assured that they got the right kind of advice from the tenant broker, and they were able to justify the broker being paid whatever the commission was.
Well, in our instance, for our clients that are listening today, they need to be working with somebody who can understand the ramifications of the next generation being burdened with what's being negotiated up front.
Right. So one time a client said, how do I know, the deal that you got me is the best deal because your commission is tied to the value of the lease? And we said, what would you do if you found out? And I think he said, I would eviscerate you. And that was all we needed to know that the way to do business is to do the right kind of business for your tenants.
This is a question for Dan, actually, on the risk management side. Can you tell us or give us a case study or something where a family-owned business, there was an event, a property and casualty major event where the risk management, the insurance really came into play, where it just made a lot of sense?
Well, so much of that happens behind the scenes that I don't know about it. The key for me when I'm working with business owners, and realistically, most all of my clients that are privately held companies are in some form or fashion a family business. They take the business home with them at night, so their spouse is certainly involved. They have children most of the time. A lot of them will say, yeah, I hope to pass this on to my children. I recently had a client who's was a father owned the company, son and daughter worked in the company. They had been clicking along through the construction days of the 04, 05, 06, 07, and they had to turn the keys over to the bank about 18 months ago. So not only the economy did this, not the insurance, but when you have something devastating like that, it affects several people. So, young John and young Susie call Dad for a loan, and he says, I don't have a job either. They're all kind of in the same boat. So when you have a situation of an insurance nature with a business, if it's not covered or you fail to take that time every year to go over and review what you really have at risk, the ramifications are certainly down the line.
We talked a little bit ago about the hesitancy that insurance is kind of an afterthought. Get as little as possible. Premiums are a waste.
I'm overinsured. We hear
exactly.
That a lot.
Insurance poor, they say.
Exactly. Yeah. And yet now we're going into we are in the midst of situations where If somebody needs to go to a bank, the bankers have kind of tightened that vault a little bit. Is there a role that better pre-planning can play? If I'm a manufacturer and I have assets in that, and I go to a bank for a loan, I'm going to lease some new equipment and I need money for that. I'm going to buy some new equipment because now I'm seeing some improvement in the economy. So somebody's sitting there saying, well, what does that have to do with insurance? Is there a role of insurance in that?
Well, there is, because your insurance costs follows the value. The more that you acquire, the higher the insurance premiums are going to be, because the bank is going to require it at a certain level anyways, whether you think it's worth that or not. One of the areas that we have been very successful in, and we're seeing this a lot more right now, with the devaluation of commercial real estate, where the bank will come to me and say, hey, he's got an $800,000 loan on the building, or on the property would be a better term. We want him to have an $800,000 insurance policy. Well, in conjunction with somebody like Josh, I can go back to Josh and say, hey, you know, what are you seeing in the marketplace as cost or construction cost for something similar to that building? And I go to other advisors as well and come up with a number. It may be $500,000 to rebuild it. So the loan is irrelevant to the insurance. The insurance will never pay more than the actual loss. And we've actually had to go to the insurance commissioner's office and have them contact the lending institution to inform them that, yes, that is true. You cannot force somebody legally to carry insurance at a limit that they'll never collect.
So it's a $300,000 delta that the bank's got to figure out how to deal with.
Yeah, that's just the risk there. Yeah. And again, we don't insure the land. Right. So if the building is gone, hopefully that land's worth
$300,000. Mm-hmm. You know, Josh, you are representing in your work the tenant side, but many of our listeners have space, and they probably have looked around and said, you know, we're not using that piece over there. We need to sublease. I'm sure that that's a strategy that people have turned to. There's a lot of evidence about that. You know, you're kind of a behind the scenes inside now. So now they're on the other side of the table and they're negotiating with somebody like yourself. And you talk about this first, they had irrational exuberance and now a little bit humbled, but how can they come to that table better prepared to negotiate their own subleasing of property that they might own?
Now you're talking about a user that owns the space or a tenant?
Right.
A tenant who leases more than they need, or both?
It could be either, but particularly, let's say a family business owner says, we've got this office lease or this, and we want to sublease it. How can I be really strong on the other side? Because if I were them right now listening, I'd be figuring I'm just cooked, you know?
Yeah.
Josh is going to come in here and get everything he can.
People say that about Stubby all the time. But you know, I think the right thing to do is to start a reserve when you own property to make sure that you have property set. You have a reserve set aside not just for repairs, but in the event that you do need to sublease space or that you need to lease space to a third party. The market is very fluid right now. People are looking for deals, and you're going to have to accept less than you probably originally thought, or certainly less than when you bought the building, if you've had the building for a couple of years, and maybe even less than you think now, even if you are willing to admit that it's a pretty dark market for a landlord right now. It's case by case. It's hard for me to say what the answer should be in a certain case, but I do think that at the end of the day, I would rely on the brokerage community to help you market the space, and rely on that broker's relationships with tenant brokers to help find a good fit. And when you find a good fit, I would do two things. I would scrutinize the financials of the tenant, of the potential subtenant, because the last thing you want to do is do that again.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you secure that with a letter of credit or a larger security deposit than maybe just a month, I would do something to get you comfortable. But I would do whatever it takes to make the deal if you have somebody interested, because the last thing you want to do is let one go and then sit for another 6 months.
Is there some sort of formula for reserves that is appropriate for that family business owner of the property to have?
You know, again,
not crazy math formula on the radio, but just general.
It's a lot of it's a level of comfort. I would, you know, I'd probably say about a year's worth of rent.
Right.
Okay.
Would probably get you there. I mean, because on the most part, I mean, it depends on the kind of space, but for office space, you know, it can sit there for a year, and a year is probably a fair amount of time that you would expect to have space in the market if you're subleasing it at such a discount beyond what the direct space from, you know, a landlord down the street would be. You know, if a landlord down the street's at $20, but you want to be at $15 because you're trying to move it quickly because you're bleeding money every month, then I think a year is a reasonable amount of time to wait.
Mm. You know, another topic that's come up, get insight from both of you. We talked about encouraging family business owners to use trusted advisors, to find somebody that they trust. And Dan, I heard you say, you know, I might call Josh. And Josh, I'm sure that you're dealing with someone who's leasing a space and they're looking at what's the insurance ramifications of this. How much do you work together as professionals, insurance and real estate, come together? And I guess the instruction I'd love to see for the family business owner is how can they best utilize a team as opposed to one or the other? Is there some value in bringing together two advisors like yourself at a time when they're either leasing space, gaining insurance, those kinds of things?
Well, I'll sort of cover this with my summation later on, but I do think that a team is one of the key things you can do when you enter this process. I'm very careful to stop when I'm representing someone when it comes to tax advice or legal advice or construction advice or insurance advice. So a good tenant broker will get you through the majority of the business points. They'll get you through some of the legal and insurance points, but I never want to give, you know, concrete advice on legal or insurance matters because I'm not an expert in it, and someone like Dan can take the ball and run, and he can really explain, you know, where the pitfalls could be the same way I could when we're talking about the, you know, advantages and disadvantages of a certain language in a sublease clause. Mm-hmm. So I can move the ball forward to a certain point, but I absolutely rely on lawyers and insurance brokers to help push things forward.
Yeah.
Ditto. No, you're absolutely right too, Josh. And it's not just from that angle, but it's also you become a trusted advisor. Josh made a point earlier about if you just want to find space or look for buildings, you know, you don't need him. If you just want to buy an insurance policy, you know what you want, you don't need me. It's not a transaction business for me. It's more involved, as Josh also mentioned, as an advisor. You know, you're getting me and my experience and my education applied to your situation for no more than anybody else.
Right.
Because we are also paid similar as Josh, paid by the insurance company. And again, obviously, they pass that cost along at some point in time. But networking for trusted advisors is key. So most people think I got my lawyer, hope I don't use him. I've got my accountant or my CPA lined up. And then they tend to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start saying, okay, well, you know, I can buy stocks online, so I really don't need Meredith, or I can get involved in different groups. And that's not the type of people Meredith works with. That's not the type Josh or I work with, especially with you, Pat, and your business. The business owner is starting to see and expand their sphere of influence and their circle of advisors. And I get a big kick out of seeing when they say, "Well, let me call my real estate guy."
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody wants to have a guy or a gal
or a gal,
gal.
In their stable of resources.
Well, I guess what I've heard the other side of that coin is if you are working with someone who says, I can be all things to you, I can be your realtor and let me give you some tax advice and let me give you some information on insurance, that's really a red flag to say, you know, wait a minute, I need to look a little bit further to open yourselves up because it doesn't cost any more to get additional input.
That's right.
You hear that, run.
That's
run
right.
Fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, imagine you do.
That's right.
So, you know, this is a point in our show where we actually try to provide our listeners with a resource of tips, and we store these online, and it's meant to be something that they can go back to. So, Josh, if you could start, I'd love for you to share your tips for our listeners.
I've got a few, and we've covered most of them in detail, but I'll just go back and sum a couple up. The first one is to make sure you hire a broker. Like Dan said, if you're just going to look for space and don't really care what the lease says, you don't need one. But what a broker can do is because the market is so fluid, he or she can explain how things are changing. Like I said, what the structure is of the different landlords, what the structure is of the different leases, how that can affect the business, how certain clauses can be inserted so that, like, if there are generational issues, you can get out of the lease. If you're expecting an M&A event, and there's a change in control, and maybe the company's acquired and there's no longer a need for the office in Atlanta, that's a huge hurdle in discussions with a private equity group or a venture group or just an acquirer to get rid of the real estate. So you want to make sure that hiring a broker who's not just going to find space, who can create competition, explain the players, that's really how, as a broker, we extract more savings than just showing up and getting a fee. The second thing is to form a team, like we talked about. I'm very careful to stop where my expertise stops. Mm-hmm. And I've got a handful of architects, contractors, lawyers, insurance brokers, so on and so forth, that, you know, in 2 seconds I pick up the phone and call, and all of a sudden we've got a team and we're off and running on a project. And if the client has one, we'll work with them. If they want to lean on us, we've got a process in place so that every angle is covered. And the landlords expect that from when you hire a tenant broker who's been doing this for a long time. They expect that they're not going to be able to get one by you, so to speak. That you've got all the angles covered, and that's probably the second most important thing. And just to sort of piggyback on that, I would start early. Some people say, especially on the family side, because I've seen this before, we can renew our lease at the end of the year. It's December. What do you think we should do? And my answer is, you have no options. I can't create any leverage for you. The landlord knows you can't do anything. I would start 12 to 18 months early. If you think it's too early, it's not. Things take a long time. Lawyers always take a long time. I would start early. I would see how the market transforms over a couple of months. Maybe opportunities come up that weren't there a few months ago. You don't ever want to be rushed into making a decision that is so key to supporting the business. So with the right team and the right preparation, I would do that. And the third thing that we talked about is yearly reviews. A lot of people sign a 10-year lease, and they put it in a drawer, and in year 9, they pull it out, and they pick up the phone, and they say, what should we do? I don't know how the business has changed. There may have been opportunities in years 3, 5, and 7 to really make some changes to the lease to improve it and support the way that things are done. For a cost, like we said, that's generally the second biggest cost on the P&L, for a lease that's so important to the way that the business is run and dictates how the operations work, and you know how the physical space supports the way that things are done for the company, I would be looking at this every year.
Excellent. Dan, what words of wisdom do you have to share?
The first one, which to me has always been the most important, maybe self-serving to some degree, but pick an agent. We run into a lot of people, if I talk to a business owner and ask them what is their approach to insurance, and they say, well, every 3 years we put together 4 packets of information and call 4 agents and tell them, you know, mm-hmm. first one's here, get to bid on our insurance. Don't put your insurance out for bid. We're not selling excess inventory here. It's a little more important than that. There is a downside to that shopping mentality as well. If you shop it every year with different people, people like myself are going to the same insurance companies. So even if you pick, you know, insurance broker A, B, and C, they may all send it to Travelers Insurance Company, to use a name. And that underwriter at Travelers Insurance Company is going to say, you know what, I see this every year from 3 different brokers. I never get the order. I'm not even going to give it much effort. So you dilute your ability to have leverage, like Josh just mentioned on the real estate side. You dilute your ability to say, hey, if you sharpen your pencil, Travelers underwriter, I may be able to get you this deal. And they say, no, I've seen it every year for 3 years. I'm not going to mess with it. So pay attention, like I mentioned earlier, once a year. I know it's hard, and I've had clients give me that after lunch eyelids start drooping down as we're discussing it and going over a few things. Try to stay with it a little bit. If you bring an agent in that you trust, you can slack off of that a little bit, and then you can stick to some minor details such as payroll levels, and then you tend to have somebody pull that up for you and your sales figures, and yes, we still have 14 trucks, and it can be rather painless from that level if you pick the right agent. Understand contracts. I probably read one to two contracts a week on average. And that can be as simple as your dumpster lease. That can be a contract with your landlord. We see a lot of those. I'm not a lawyer. Josh mentioned earlier a list of things he's not. I'm also not those things. But it's amazing some of the legal language that are in these contracts that your insurance policy has never been intended to and may not even be able to protect you for the liability you've just accepted by signing that document. So make sure those limits are looked at because, you know, again, I'm not a lawyer, but you put yourself, if you sign that and say, yes, I agree, you're immediately in violation of that contract if your insurance is not able to follow it. We tend to see sometimes on a transactional contract where it looks like they did a cut and paste on a real estate contract, and you start seeing language that's mixed up. I saw one yesterday that was using traditional auto liability limits for general liability. So find an agent that understands enough about that to at least red flag it and tell you to go back to your attorney, have them review that as well. And, you know, like I said, taxes, pull it out once a year, knock it out, and put it away. And as a business owner, go back to doing what you do well, which is what puts you in a position to own that business.
Excellent. Those are great tips. Spoken like a true risk management professional. Gentlemen, some of our listeners may want to reach out to you and get some insight. Josh, if they wanted to do that, how could they find you?
The website for Studley is www.studley.com, S-T-U-D-L-E-Y. My email is jhirsh@studley.com, so jhirsh@studley, and you can reach me at the office at 404-504-0015.
Great.
What about you, Dan?
Well, the website we've got is excellent, but it's generic because we have so many offices, and that's changing as we speak, actually. The best way, just call me direct. I spend a great deal of my time on the phone giving advice. You may be in a good situation with your agent, at least you think you do. You have a question, maybe you're embarrassed to ask them. I get these calls all the time.
Second opinions are wonderful, aren't they?
Yeah, when you ask for them.
Right.
So that's perfect, Meredith. 678-715-0415 is a direct line to my office. If I'm not there, I get that forwarded to my cell phone and available just about any time.
Wonderful, guys. Well, we really appreciate you all coming out, and we feel like we got a wealth of knowledge today, and we appreciate all of our listeners out there.
Yeah, and I just want to remind our listeners that they can go to our site, which is www.familybusinessradio.businessradiox.com. You will see information on today's show. You'll see a recap, and the podcast will be available early next week from our show, and all of the contact information from our guests will be there as well. So thank you very much.
See you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.